Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for joining me today. I was reading about Zerubbabel. What a great way to start the show. And like many of us, he knew how to start well. But he found it hard to keep going. And his success depended on the quality of the encouragement he received. So I want you to have lots of encouragement today from the show. And Zerubbabel let discouragement get the better of him. But when he let God take control, the work was finished. God is always in control, and we must not let circumstances or lack of encouragement slow us from doing the things that God has us to do that's before us today. Plus, it's just really fun to say Zerubbabel. So we've got a great show coming up today, so stay put. Rick McKinley is going to be with us in just a minute, and you're going to enjoy him. We'll take a short break and be right back in just a minute.
Following an election, it's good to recommit to pray for the leaders in our communities and our nation. 1 Timothy 2 says, pray for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. Would you join with us this week in praying for our country? And become part of the Faith Radio prayer team. You'll receive weekly reminders and ways to pray specifically for our homes, communities, and our country. Find out more and sign up today at myfaithradio.com/prayer.
Stay informed on the latest events, compelling interviews, resource giveaways, and more by receiving the Faith Radio newsletter. It's an email we send out once a month that also includes inspiration from God's Word. Learn more about how God is using Faith Radio to bring clarity, healing, and hope to people all over the world. Sign up for the Faith Radio newsletter under subscriptions at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back to the show. Rick McKinley is my guest, and he seems like the kind of person everyone would like to have as a friend. He did his theological work at Gordon Conwell Seminary and is founder and lead pastor of Imago Dei Community, and he's the author of 5 books, so you know he doesn't sit around doing nothing. He's a busy guy. He's a nationally known speaker at conferences, including Q with Gabe Lyons. We like Gabe. Catalyst and the Justice Conference. In 2012, Portland Magazine voted him one of Portland's 50 most influential people. How cool is that? He's with us today. His recent book is called Faith for the Moment, Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. I think your book and your message is so timely. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Yeah, and I mean it. The timeliness of your book is spot on. We live in a polarized world like never before.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. At least in Portland, that can turn into a pretty crazy scene.
Yeah, Portland has gotten pretty animated. I saw some footage of some pretty violent stuff going on in downtown Portland.
Yeah, lots of protesting, rioting, fighting on both sides. It's the sad part is, just this last week, an older woman in our congregation who's from Uganda, and is single and rides the bus to feed homeless people on Friday, said, I don't think I'll go out this week, the week of the election, because it's not safe.
Wow.
That gives you an idea of at least the fear that's carried by people and how they see Portland in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Rick, you say in your book that a lot of Christians, in America anyway, they feel like they're exiles within their own country, and they want to kind of return to a Christendom of an idealized past. I think we all have kind of feelings of that from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hopeful things I think about our moment is that if you think of our marginalized place in society, and that seems to be growing more and more evident, when you look at the scriptures, you see that the people of God have been in this marginal place for pretty much ever, always, mm-hmm. in all times. And so even in the literal exile, when Israel was taken to Babylon, I mean, they lost everything that validated their faith, from the king to land to a temple to a priesthood, and found themselves in this whole other culture. And yet somehow they didn't get assimilated fully into that culture. They figured out how to distinctly practice their faith in a way that would, you know, bless Babylon, as Jeremiah says. He writes to the exiles and says, seek the peace and the prosperity of the city, but also resisted, you know, the idols of the culture. And we see Daniel and his friends as perfect examples of that, when they were a huge asset to the king, and they served in his court. But at the same time, they had moments where they said, no, I'm not going to quit praying. I'm not going to eat the royal food. Whatever those issues were, they were discerning in the moment that this is what faithfulness looks like. Mm.
Rick, so despite all of their huge loss, they hung on to their identity. And now we fast forward into today's world, where there are a lot of Christians who feel like they've lost their identity, and they've actually mm-hmm. compromised their some of their strongest allegiance. Can you explain what is the difference? What has happened?
Well, I think, you know, if we don't understand our story as the people of God and recognize that this, what we're experiencing today, is normal for the people of God throughout their history, then I think there's a ton of anxiety, like, what's wrong? And there seems to be three reactions. One is that we're just going to baptize Babylon. We'll just say whatever the culture says is good and true, then we'll somehow fit it into following Jesus. And what happens there is that just gets fully assimilated, right? Mm-hmm. There's no good news that critiques a broken world. And we see a lot of that, a lot of Christians who are basically letting go of the truth in order to find friendly ground, so to speak. Wow. And then I think on the other side is a different kind of assimilation that says we need to take back we need to take back our country, our values, those structures that validated our faith back in the good old days, whenever those were. And the message of Scripture is neither of those is really accurate. Both of them are about self-preservation. And Jesus' way has always been self-sacrifice to proclaim a different kingdom. And so when we watch him navigate through the Gospels and we watch the New Testament church, there is this sense that their blessing, with this faithful presence of Jesus, is so peculiar and radical and full of grace and mercy, and yet simultaneously they're resisting. The phrase "Jesus is Lord" in Acts was a political statement. It's Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. And Caesar was the only one who was understood as Lord at that time. So there's also that sense that we're to be a prophetic witness. We're to say, look, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And if we navigate that tightrope well, I think we are the ones that get transformed in the process.
Mm. Really well said, Rick. I appreciate that insight. I didn't know that about Jesus Lord, that comment. That was interesting as well. So do you think we're living in a new Babylon?
I mean, when you look at, let's say, the books of 1 Peter, 2 Peter, you hear him refer to Babylon metaphorically and exile metaphorically.
Okay.
And so I think it's sort of both and. You know, there definitely is the mindset of Babylon is the mindset of empire. And empire, you know, is built upon financial security, military security, those sorts of things. And we all live within the context of an empire, you know, whether it's here or somewhere else, mm-hmm. or at some other time in history. But the ethos of Babylon is definitely prevalent in American culture, which is primarily about the self, that I construct myself and understand myself based on what I can get for myself and secure myself. And so that shows up with money and power and sex and things that we see getting really distorted in our culture. So it's in that place that I think the church is called to be faithful in a really different way than we see happening in the empire, so to speak.
Rick, you did some deep thinking in this book, for sure. I love the way the depth you went into this, and even asking a question like, what was the objective Nebuchadnezzar had in taking the Jewish people captive, and how would that connect? How would that connect with today's world?
Well, what was interesting as I studied that was, you know, when Pharaoh in Egypt took the people of God into slavery, his purpose was oppression. You know, he was just using them. But Nebuchadnezzar had a different approach because Babylon was such an advanced society and had one of the seven wonders of the world at the time. His hope was assimilation, that you would eventually be so captured by the delights of Babylon and the people of Babylon that they would just be assimilated into Babylon. And so they had freedom to start businesses, live a middle kind of lower middle class income. But the hope was you would just basically get assimilated. So when I think about us in an American culture, I think that's always the threat for the church. We're all consumers. I like Amazon as much as the next person. Mm-hmm. I like the convenience. But we can easily get assimilated into the idea that everything does exist for me, and my security is ultimately in what I can make of myself and what I can secure for myself, or even how I construct myself, whether that's my sexual identity or my vocational identity or whatever it is. And the gospel is such a different, you know, answer to those questions, that you are who you are because God created you and named you and called you to himself. And the freedom, actually, that he brings, the freedom from the self so that you can exist for God and others. It's so counterculture. And secularism and consumerism and all these isms have really shaped how we think and experience life. So oftentimes Christianity is just another sticker that I put on myself as I construct my identity,
mm-hmm.
Versus, no, Jesus is Lord of all things, and that radically reshapes how I understand myself and reality and my place in it.
Well, I'm talking to Rick McKinley, and the book that he is referring to is his latest book called Faith for This Moment, Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. We'll take a little break, and then we'll come back lots more with Rick McKinley in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Rick McKinley. He's written a book, one of five. This one's called Faith for This Moment, Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. And if you're like me, and I know I am, you're learning some things today. Rick has got some deep thoughts in that brain of his. And we are, I'm curious about, in chapter 7, Rick, you talk about discovering the rhythms of grace through spiritual practices. I'm a huge fan of spiritual practices, so help me with that.
Yeah, when we look at how we can live a life that changes us and is distinct in a culture like ours, with these profound ways that Jesus lived and thought about hospitality, generosity, our calling in marriage and singleness and vocation, as well as Sabbath and worship, And ultimately, all those wrap around the practice of hearing and obeying the Word of God and the Spirit of God. So when you think about hospitality in a culture that's built around kind of isolation, that, first of all, I have to get transformed first. I have to, you know, say, Jesus, I maybe don't love my neighbors and don't love people who are different than me like you want me to. And then open up your table to people who aren't just like you, who maybe have different opinions about politics or different stories or different races. And coming together around food, Jesus brought so many different people together in that way. And it's a blessing as you experience it, but it also is prophetic. It critiques this idea that we, you know, travel around in tribes of affinity and we all agree on the same things. But that it's not about our ideas as much as about our personhood. And when we're together, we believe Christ comes with us, right? He sits with us. Beautiful opportunities for evangelism and pastoral care and all those things that Christ did when he showed up at those meals.
So when we think about some of our securities in this life, we evaluate them. How can we? It's a good diagnostic tool to ask ourselves. Let's look at what we consider our securities, and see if that causes our hearts to drift away from God. Because I think we're all interested in being secure.
And I agree with you, and I think for all of us, we find our security in money and, you know, whatever sense of power or freedom or however we name those things. That's where the early church is so convicting, because they ultimately did have such an encounter with the mercy of Christ and the person of Christ that they gave their very lives up, you know. And sometimes I think that if we were in a culture that was persecuting Christians, it would almost be easier, because you just knew, you know, the lines in the sand. But in a culture that is like ours, it's sort of a frog in the kettle effect, that you start slowly finding your security in, you know, these small pleasures. And before you know it, you know, you're dreaming at night about buying your fourth, you know, flat screen TV for your house because it's going to be so great, you know, and you just slowly ease into going, man, my security's in things, or my security's in my alone time, or it's in my bank account. And all of those are contrary to what Christ calls us.
Yeah, and when crisis comes into your life, and it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when, it usually rattles that sense of well-being, despite how many flat-screen TVs you have.
Yeah, and it is when those moments when life becomes really clear, because the emptiness of those false securities is evident, right? It's the crisis where we can only call on God. And so the challenge is, what are the rhythms of our week? What are our practices that keep God in front of us? And I think for so many followers of Jesus, it's been sort of reduced to read your Bible, pray, and go to church. And then you have to go live your real life. And what we're arguing for is, no, when you sit down to eat, that should be a practice where people and Jesus are at the table with you. When you go to work, that's the place where you're sent for a very different purpose than maybe the person next to you, that you're working as a missionary for Christ to see his world flourish. And when we spend our money and give our money, how we think about money, and which we're spending all the time, right? That should be a practice that calls us back to Jesus. And when we rest, which we don't do very well.
No, we don't.
But Sabbath. Sabbath is such a prophetic thing right now. When all of our technology is about distracting us and calling us to check it. At this point, if you go to the bathroom without your cell phone, it's considered an act of solitude.
Yeah.
Because we are always on. So, you know, if you met a person who said, you know what, I turn everything off once a week and my family and I play together and pray together and we have friends over, that sounds like freedom, you know, to me. And one of the effects of Babylon or the Babylonian kind of mindset is anxiety. We all live stressed and anxious and striving all the time, and there's never space to stop and realize we don't have to be productive. We don't have to, you know, accomplish. This is God's world. He's running it. He gave it to us to partner with him, but also to enjoy and ultimately enjoy him. And so those, you know, you think about, those are things that everybody does all week long. We work, we sleep, we eat, we spend, we rest. But if we can align those rhythms with who Christ is and practice those things with that intention, all of a sudden it's not just a Sunday experience, but it's my entire life now is being realigned with the person and work of Jesus.
I love that, and I love the practices that you just spoke of, and I want to try to review those with the time we have left. You said mealtime is important, work is important. Help me with the last three.
Yeah, hospitality.
Hospitality.
Hospitality at our tables and generosity.
Generosity,
how
yep.
we spend
yep.
our money and
yep.
what we give it to. And then vocation, the fact that we don't just go work a job. We're actually called and sent
mm-hmm.
by God to work for human flourishing.
Yes.
And then celebration, like worship and Sabbath,
yes, yes.
has become big anchors. And all of those are contingent upon the first practice, which is to hear and obey the Word of God and the Spirit of God.
Mm-hmm. Rick, those are
all... Our posture isn't just about learning information, but it's actually, I'm listening so that I'm ready to respond.
Yeah. Rick, those are all solid points my listeners will put in a brown paper bag and walk through their front door with tonight.
I hope so. I hope so. We could... the church has a lot of power to be prophetic and to bless this culture, but I think you're right. It starts with us being transformed ourselves.
Yeah, and people will walk in and open that bag, and they'll go, honey, what's in the bag? And they'll go, hey, practices for deeper spiritual formation. Thanks to Rick McKinley.
Yeah.
Yep. Rick, it's been a delight. Rick's book is Faith for This Moment, Navigating a Polarized World as the People of God. Rick McKinley has been my guest. Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, blessings on you and your day. We'll take a little break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I know my next guest has a lot of frequent flyer miles, and he probably gets really good deals on rental cars because he does all of that a lot because he travels across the country speaking to thousands of pastors and parents and business leaders on how to engage and empower millennials. He's written a book called The Passive Generation, The Seemingly Reckless, Definitely Disruptive, But Far From Hopeless Millennials. My guest is Grant Skelton. Grant, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I was absolutely correct about my your frequent flyer miles and your car rentals. You travel quite a bit, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I am slowing down quite a bit, but because of the book, it does require a lot of traveling. And there are a lot of parents that are trying to raise millennials.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pastors that are trying to reach them. And there's a lot of, even I joke, but it's serious, that there's a lot of business leaders that are trying to retain millennials right now.
You bet they are.
That's a big pain point.
You bet. So obviously, a lot of people are studying millennials, but they're just really still quite misunderstood. Why do you think this is?
I think one of the biggest reasons millennials are so studied but still misunderstood is because they're mostly studied, and I would say more importantly, they're represented not by themselves. They're represented by older generations, which is older generations can do great research on millennials, but it would be like men doing all the content and research to figure out what women want. you can do great research. It's just there's going to be probably a missing piece, and I don't know if women would proudly say, hey, this is the book that represents me. And so that's kind of what's happened a lot with millennials, a lot of blogs, a lot of articles, a lot of podcasts, a lot of jokes, mostly by non-millennials on millennials.
Yeah. And you are engaging pastors, parents, and I even find it interesting, a lot of business leaders that are trying to figure out how to retain millennials, how to get into their skin and figure out what makes them work best and what makes them happy. And what's that like?
I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot. I was very lucky and privileged to be discipled at a very young age and poured into by an older man. My father is not a strong believer. I'm not sure if he is a believer because he doesn't tend to talk about the Lord much. But for this man, 2 weeks into me being a Christian, I share this in the first chapter, he took me under his wing and he poured into me. And that really changed how I saw what being a man looked like, what being a father looked like, what being a husband looked like. And so whenever the millennial problem kind of came into the picture a lot more, I had already felt like I wanted to be a bridge builder between that because Kevin, the guy who discipled me, introduced me to just a new world. And so I enjoy it. I like helping. And I personally don't think millennials are going to change the world by themselves. I think they need the wisdom of the generation before them.
Mm-hmm. The millennials that I speak to often talk about their jobs that are always changing, and how they're sometimes less interested in going to church. And, you know, the trend is making me real curious as to what's behind all this. Do you have insight on that one?
For jobs in church specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah, for jobs, I do think that even the reason it's called the Passion Generation is because I feel like millennials – kind of grew up where they got to see their parents really dedicate their whole life to a job, especially their father. Not all millennials, it's pretty fairly general, but I have found this to be very popular where we saw our dads give their entire life and even sometimes soul to a job and then gave the leftover energy to their family and kids.
Mm-hmm.
And really the weekends was just to escape their job. And so they were never looking forward to Monday. And I think this is a generation that doesn't just want to provide through their job. They want to fulfill their passion through their job. And so they want to look forward to Monday. They want to be excited about the future. I also think there's a lot of, even the idea of a midlife crisis, that means that there's generally this idea that you give your whole life to something and wonder if it's even worth it. And I think a lot of millennials saw their parents do that, and they're wondering if it's worth it for them to dedicate decades of their life to it. However, I will say we can often without wisdom, go the swift the pendulum to the other side, where it's giving our life just to passion, and that's almost impossible to just do what you're passionate about. No one gets that kind of job, especially in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You made a reference to your mentor, which makes me think that at the root of a lot of issues with millennials is a lack of discipleship. Would you say more about that?
Yeah, I didn't realize that discipleship wasn't a normal thing for Christians until I grew up more into the faith. Because I got saved, actually the first time I went to this church in March 8, 2006, and then I got discipled 2 weeks after that by a man who went out of his way to find me and reach out to me.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear more about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so he really invited me into his life. He let me join his life. It wasn't really just having coffee once a week and talking about my life. It was joining his life. In fact, for a year and a half of me being discipled by him, we only met one-on-one twice that I can recall of where we met. So I think a lot of times we confuse discipleship and mentorship. And to me, mentorship is come and meet with me. And that's if he would have met with me once a week, once a month. But discipleship isn't come and meet with me. And that's not what Jesus did. He said, come and follow me. And so that's what Kevin did with me, is he allowed me to join his life. And in the book, I talk about allowing young people to join your personal life. That could be your hobbies, your family life, of course, your family, your work life, if possible, and even your church life.
Mm-hmm.
So not all four, unless if you can, but definitely inviting someone in, including them, not just adding them to your calendar.
I can say, Grant, I love that. That's a very cool story. But I'm now curious as to what kinds of activities you and Kevin did. You obviously came alongside him, and he was modeling certain things, and you were he brought you into his life. So what were some of the things you did? Because this fascinates me.
Yeah, I think some of the biggest stuff, and I would say the area of his life that I follow him probably the most is definitely his church life and his work life. It's a unique thing because he was a pastor, so he was a youth pastor.
Okay.
And so him preparing a message, him leading a small group, he kind of led the leadership team within the youth ministry. And my youth ministry was a little abnormal. It was about 600 high school students.
Wow. 600?
So pretty massive, large. Yeah, just for high school.
That's crazy.
Bigger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he would lead the small group for about 12 to 15 of the key core leaders of the 600. And, I mean, I'm a new Christian, and he invites me to join this core team of leaders. And so I feel like I took the fast track into leading in the church. But then he started entrusting me to speak and to share and to make decisions and to critique what they were doing and create solutions. He really gave me responsibility I really didn't deserve at that point or earn, but it really shifted my posture of thinking, man, I gotta grow up. Like, man, I need to read the Bible more, or man, I need to pray and rely on the Lord more. I think when you give people responsibility, especially young people, it matures them quite quickly.
I know you live in Dallas right now, Grant, and I'm trying to think, was this youth group in Texas? Because only in Texas could you have a youth group of 600 people in it.
Yeah, it was in Dallas.
At least I feel relieved knowing that it's Texas. Of course, you have 600 kids in your youth group. All right, now, in the title of your book,
for sure,
you also use the word definitely disruptive as it applies to millennials. I do want more on that one.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, they're getting married later. They are graduating college, I guess, later as well, if at all. They're moving in with their parents a lot more than generations before. There's a lot of things that they are doing differently. They are job hopping. The average millennial is on a trajectory right now, according to Barna, to have 14 jobs by the time that they're 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are a very different generation, how they pursue things. Part of that is technology. I think part of that is culture has really changed a lot in their generation. But those are some of the disruptive things that are definitely impacting certain marketplace industries, impacting the family unit, and even especially impacting the church right now. About 7 out of 10 young people, once they graduate and go into college, are leaving the church. And so that's kind of created this whole tension or division, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And what is your understanding as to why they are leaving the church?
Why are they leaving the church? That is, I do think it's pretty multifaceted. But I have a whole book on it, but it's hard to sum it up. I would say
sure.
A big, big, big part of it is sometimes church can feel like an event. And ironically, I don't think pastors want it to be an event. They would even preach that it's not an event. But a lot of times, I mean, I had a mentor once tell me, what you count and what you celebrate creates your culture. And sometimes it seems like our culture in the church is to count and celebrate how many people show up on a Sunday. It's even how a pastor would be asked to introduce himself. Or if you meet a pastor, or even go to a church, it'll be like, what's your name? Oh, you're a pastor? Oh, about how big is your church?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
totally.
A metric of success.
Yeah.
But that's not fully, and I don't think, and I know a lot of pastors wish that wasn't the case. It's one of the few occupations where you have to put a numeric value to your occupation. Teachers don't have to, like, say the average, grade point average for their kids. But pastors have to say this number of how big it is. And so I think that sometimes the scorecard or the metrics should just be expanded a little bit more. We should broaden the scorecard to what does it look like to impact your city? Like, how much are you guys doing that? Or how many people in your church are discipling someone? Questions that would, I think, basically I'd sum it up that I feel like millennials sometimes want to be a part of something bigger than themselves that's making a difference in the community and in the world. And I know the church is called to do that, but sometimes it seems like nonprofits and causes and social entrepreneur organizations are doing it more. And so for for all the young people leaving the church, I found that they are joining. It's not because they just want to sit around. It's because they want to join something that is doing something and going. And so I often say, we need to get this cause-oriented generation to join the most cause-oriented organization in the world, which is the church. But the only reason I think they're not joining the church, which is the greatest cause, is because we're kind of neglecting the Great Commission, which is go and make disciples and go and impact the rest of the world.
Yeah, I know millennials today very much are cause-oriented. They definitely want to be passionate about a cause. And I suppose if they're not finding that cause and that mission in the church, they're going to wander somewhere else. And I know there's also a lot of pressures that they feel just among their peers for regarding social justice issues and things where, you know, they're seeing things in the world that aren't popular that the church is standing for. So they're putting church aside, which is sad.
Yeah, that is true. That's true for sure.
Yeah, I'm talking to Grant Skelton. He's written a book called The Passion Generation, and that is in fact true. If you know a millennial, if you have one in your home, or maybe one just left your home, and you maybe employ a bunch of millennials, you know they are a passion generation. The subtitle of the book is The Seemingly Reckless, Definitely Disruptive, But Far From Hopeless Millennials. We're going to take a break when we come back. I want to find out from Grant about the hope that they have and why maybe they're misunderstood. We'll take a short break and be back more with Grant Skelton in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm having a conversation with Grant Skelton. He's written a book called The Passion Generation. And if you know a millennial, or you have one yourself, or you work with them, or you employ them, you're going to want to pay very careful attention, because his book is exactly addressing that. Millennials are commonly misunderstood by many. Grant, if we would, talk about that.
Part of the misunderstanding, I think, of millennials is that they are lazy. I hear that probably, or entitled a lot of times. There's a chapter in the book I call Passion, Purpose, and Provision, and it is on that idea of them choosing their job, even their major, in their trajectory of their life based off more passion than just providing financially. And I think that's really created a lot of this misunderstanding is when I ask the average millennial, how often do your parents show concern about how much money you make or how much money you don't make? Hmm. And they usually laugh. They're like, man, all the time. I always get asked by my parents about that, or they share a lot of concern about that, or they wish I would take another job or do a different major or want to be something else other than the job I want in my future. And so it seems functionally like our parents are very concerned about provision. I liken it to Dead Poet Society, where the son, Neil, wants to go into theater. But his father says, hey, I've worked way too hard to get you into this school so that you can be a doctor. And so this is where the tension between Neil's passion or his parents' loving and good intentions for provision kind of collide. And so what I think is sometimes maybe millennials aren't lazy. Maybe they're just uninspired by the American dream that has been put before us, as well as I don't know if the American dream works like it maybe used to.
Probably doesn't, yeah. Yeah, the millennials are certainly in a different position than their parents, and they're certainly going to face different challenges. We're coming out of the last generation that's going to have a job for 40 years and get a gold watch and then retire.
Is that a real thing? People really got a gold watch at the end of their
they
career?
Did. Yeah, exactly at the time when it didn't matter if they ever kept time again, they get a watch. You should get a gold watch day one of your employment. Now, be on time or else we're going to can you. They get it at the end when I don't even know why you'd want it at that point. It's like, I'm retired. I'm not going to look at the clock anymore. All right. Now, Grant, let's talk about your years of experience working with millennials. I know we all want to bridge the gaps with everybody. I'd like to build the better gap with millennials. I'd like to build better gaps with the elderly. I mean, I always want to build bridges. So maybe you talk about how we can better build those bridges to that group, the millennials.
Yeah, I mean, if that's probably the number one question I get is how do we reach millennials? Mostly, I would say lately by pastors. And ironically, I think I have one, the closest thing I could say to a silver bullet on how to reach millennials is something we've already talked about. It's simply do what Jesus did and do what Jesus said, and that's go and make disciples. The irony of my book is it's a book that is using millennials as a launching pad, but the real message is discipleship, which works for every generation before and after. In fact, I actually think that we don't have a millennial problem. We have at the core a discipleship problem that has played itself out into a millennial problem. And it will continue to play itself out into a Z generation problem if we continue to neglect discipleship. It's not that we had stopped discipling once millennials came around. I feel like we've been neglecting discipleship for a couple of decades now. However, when we choose to not disciple, we forfeit discipleship and influence to the culture and to the world. And the world used to be generally good, kind of side gig. You should still go to church, even if you do whatever you want on the weekend, show up to church. Your heart didn't have to be in it, but it was kind of be a morally decent, good person. Now the culture is radically different than it was 30 years ago. And so when we continue to forfeit discipleship to the culture, now it's very clear, okay, they are not walking with Christ anymore, mm-hmm. and they do not feel obligated to go to church anymore.
Now, I know you've got lots of experience working to bridge generational gaps. What have been some of the challenges you have faced personally?
Probably the biggest one, I'll say one of my generation's end is I do struggle with the lack of hunger among millennials. I think that it really requires hunger, even more than availability of the older generation, in order for discipleship to work. For example, a seasoned leader could say, hey, I'll make myself available. You can join me in my work life, my church life, my personal life, my family life. But if you do not have that hunger to join my life, to move your life around my life, then it's not going to work. And so for Jesus and his disciples, they actually messed up quite a bit. They weren't the perfect group, if you will. They argued for the left hand and the right hand of the Father. They cut people's ears off. They fell asleep when Jesus was praying. That was just a few of the things that we all know they did. But the one thing they did seem to have is this hunger and desire to continue to follow him. Even in John 6, when Jesus said, are you guys going to leave me also? Peter speaks up and says, where else would we go? And so they have that hunger, and I think it really hinges on having that hunger. Without that, it's very hard to do discipleship, and that's been a challenge. And that's where I've had to be an advocate and a champion to my own generation, is mm-hmm. kind of wake them up to the need for hunger in order to get discipled.
Grant, don't millennials want to be inspired? Isn't that just a place in life when you want to be looking up to people that you admire and whose life you want to follow? Or are they overly skeptical or cynical, or just trying to figure out why they don't have the hunger?
It's interesting because I would say they're both. They do want to be inspired and they are skeptical. I do think they want something new, so maybe they're a little skeptical when they're told to keep doing what we did. I mean, it's a very common saying from probably older generations for generations, saying, like, back when I was younger, this is what we had to do, and so you should too. That's, I think, going to spike skepticism. Mm-hmm. But when you say the inspired part too, though, I think of how quickly young people will jump on some type of cause or some type of thing that's going to help people. Like, there's this desire among even non-Christian millennials just to be a part of something that helps people and cares for those who are marginalized. There is a propensity towards good that has come out of this generation. My hope is that we can connect that to, again, the greatest cause there is, and that's the gospel moving through the church.
Amen. Grant Sheldon. Okay, let me ask you this. I know there's been lots of victories you have witnessed along the way. Do you have one or two to share? I love victories.
Yeah, I mean, I would say for me, a big victory is there's more and more seasoned leaders that I have met that are very excited about the future of the church and very excited about the future generations. I sometimes can feel, and I've seen this a lot from millennials, sometimes it can feel like the Christians above 40 are kind of a little time, sometimes fear-based in how they see the future, like really worried, like we're going to lose, as if the church, I don't know, like as if God's not in control sometimes, based off politics and the news and all of this. And then they get even more fearful when it comes to seeing the way our generation is and doubting what is going to happen. And I am seeing that die down a lot and a lot. Every probably 6 months, I see more and more leaders that are more hopeful. And that's also a big part, is I see young Christians that are hungry, and not only hungry, they want to show honor to those that have gone before them. And so it's creating a lot more unity. It's creating a lot more synergy. And it's creating a lot more hope for the future of the church in America.
I love that. I love that there is hope for the next generation of believers through the millennials. And I think one of the things I'm going to walk away with from just our discussion, Grant, is the idea that it's not a millennial issue as much as it is a discipleship issue. And if we were to ask our listeners, my listeners right now, are you actively involved in discipling a millennial? I just wondered if we would hear crickets. Or we would hear a lot of people with hands going up saying, no, 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 I am.
Yeah, I mean, I have found not too much hands go up when I have spoken to thousands now.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit over 150,000 at this point. And if I just gauged it myself, I feel like I'd say, from my experience, probably only about 20% of people are discipling someone. And so this will always impact every generation, and we'll always probably critique the next generation. And what I say is you can't expect what you don't invest. And this isn't a new thing. Jesus said, you reap what you sow. And so I could complain about it all day, or I could try to do something about it. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to change the question from how do we reach millennials, which is the wrong question. It should be, how do we disciple millennials and train millennials and mobilize millennials so that they can reach the Z generation?
Mm-hmm.
The Z generation this year became larger than millennial generation and more diverse than the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real conversation. The reason millennials matter most, in my opinion right now, and this is me as a millennial, is so that we are trained and mobilized to disciple and impact them. Because if we think millennials are bad, man, wait till this generation after them that is so different and grew up where the generation before them totally basically rejected God and the church. That's gonna have a huge ripple effect if we do not train and disciple the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm. Grant, how old are you?
I'm 28.
Awesome. A lot of wisdom for a 28-year-old. At what age do you become Kevin and you take someone under your wing and start letting them, and you're inviting them into your life, or have you already done that?
8 years ago. Every year until I die, hopefully. But 8 years ago, I started discipling.
Awesome. Awesome. I know that's a big encouragement. Just as a reminder, too, to all the listeners, that this is what Jesus calls us to do, is go and make disciples, and how important it is to be active in being a disciple maker. So, Grant, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story and your book. The book is called The Passion Generation, The Seemingly Reckless, Definitely Disruptive, but Far From Hopeless Millennials. Grant Skelton has been my guest. Grant, thanks so much for coming on the show, and bless you throughout the rest of your day.
Thank you, Bill.
You bet. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.